you know, when I first met Di and saw her like passion for marine mammals, I asked her if you could save 20 whales or 20 humans, what would you do? And she said, I'd save the humans because one human could save 2,000 whales.
I mean, I would just add to that, that we all belong, but we also, as belongers, as people in that space, we need to accept some responsibility as well. And, you know, and it's easy to throw your hands up and, you know, there's nothing we can do, but just find what you can do, because there is something that we can all do. Just find your thing that you can do. Whatever it is, there's something that we can all do. And if we all do that one thing, it will make a difference for sure.
That's Charlotte Dunn and Diane Claridge. And this is the Rain Studios podcast.
It's me and my little one, my tiny female here, Ms. Riley Soleil. And we're back. We are, it's been about 3 years since I have dropped an episode, and so much has happened, I can't even begin to go into it all. But I have experienced some major divine calling to return to the podcast platform and warming us back to this incredible medium of communication and message sharing are Diane Claridge and Charlotte Dunn of the Bahamian Marine Mammalian Research Organization of the Bahamas. And this is a long time fantasy for me to be speaking with marine biologists and in the field of conservation. Some of you might remember that many, many years ago, me and a friend of mine, we created this beverage called Rainwater. And we produced it for about a year. And I quickly decided that I just didn't want to be a part of another plastic bottle on a shelf. But my connection to the water is a lifelong love. And I just feel like it's really time to lean into that from a conservation standpoint. So this is me kind of sticking my toe into what my authentic self has always truly cared about. Many of the great teachers always kind of remind us that who we were and who we are can often be dialed back to what we really love when we were, you know, between the ages of like 5, 6, 7 years old. And for me, that was spending most of my time alone, actually, with wildlife at the ocean, at the Gulf of Mexico, on the panhandle of Florida, in a nature preserve. And just 1 week a year, sometimes 2 weeks a year, we would spend time in the Abacos, in this incredibly remote place of the Bahamas. And I just absolutely fell in love there as well. And that's where our guests today hail from. And Diane and Charlotte have been doing marine mammal research for over 30 years in this location and created this incredible organization. And we're really here to support them. You know, this is a shout out to support them and hear their story. And just it's the small things. It truly is the small things that we can do to remind ourselves that we as humans do belong to the natural world. It is not, you know, humans and nature. It's one. We're all here on this planet together, sharing space. And it's like, we might as well start acting like it, you know? What are some things we can do to start acting and taking some responsibility for our natural world? So I give you this amazing conversation from me and Riley Soleil and Charlotte and Diane. So we began this podcast many, many years ago to help us all, myself and the listeners and the guests, reconnect to our authentic self. So that is the gift of this podcast today, for me and hopefully for all of you. Without further ado, Charlotte and Diane of Goodwill.
Recording in progress, Riley. So we are going to begin with who you both are. Diane and Charlotte here of BIMRO. And I would like for you to explain BIMRO now that I'm proud of myself that I know how to say the acronym. Like let the listeners know what BIMRO is and who you both are.
Okay, it looks like Charlotte just looked at me, so it looks like I'm going first. My name is Diane Claridge. I am from Nassau in the Bahamas. Grew up boating in these beautiful waters and saw my first dolphin when I was sailing along at probably 12 years old in my sunfish. And have since...
Wait, can you, for the listeners, for someone who doesn't know what a sunfish is, can you explain that beautiful vision a little bit more?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, so saw my first dolphin when I was sailing along, probably 12 years old, in sunfish, which is a small, like, one-person boat that kids learn to sail on. I wouldn't say it changed my life, but it's a very strong memory that I have about marine mammals. I mean, I need to preface that. Saw my first wild dolphin in that scene. But I
had seen a captivity dolphin. Is that what you're saying?
On this, the experience on the sunfish was seeing my first wild dolphin.
Rain's asking, did you had seen?
Yeah, previously I had seen captive dolphins at the Nassau Seafloor Aquarium, which was a really awful place if you're a dolphin,
right?
Because the tanks were small and not well cleaned, and it turns out that those dolphins that were there had been captured in Eleuthera. And later in my life I see them again, and see one of them in the wild after it's been it wasn't illegally released from a sea pen, but it was
encouraged,
perhaps. I had nothing to do with it, but anyway, yeah, so that sort of came full circle. But yeah, I have always had an interest in the sea and being in the sea and on the sea, and as a result of that, have pursued a career in studying marine mammals, and that work brought me back to the Bahamas a few decades ago. And with others like Charlotte, we founded the Bahamas Marine Mammal Research Organization.
See, it just rolls off your tongue so naturally.
Not very good.
Mammal Research Organization. Ooh, I just did it.
Yeah. Well, it is a mouthful.
But what's your little child baby lovely called again?
She's Riley Soleil.
Riley was reacting at all the right time.
Oh.
Yeah, she was. That's amazing. Yeah.
Maybe we do need to put this on YouTube, like, just for Riley.
Yeah. She was, like, really in the story.
Yeah, well, the longevity of our organization's name is, it's because we're stuck in that, you know, we wanted Bahamas, which is already a long word. Because we didn't, even though we're based on Abaco Island, we didn't want to just focus on work in Abaco Island.
Mm.
We didn't want just dolphins, because we do work with whales and manatees as well, and you know, any marine mammal species that we could find here. Yeah, you get stuck with, well, and we definitely wanted research in the name because our focus is research.
Oh, it's the perfect name. It is a mouthful, you know.
It's a huge mouthful.
But BIMRO is so liberating. Like, but you have, that's why the podcast format is so great, because for the listeners can be like, oh yeah, BIMRO. Like, did you hear about BIMRO? And it's like easy to say. It's very, very, and it's got a nice little pizzazz to it.
Do you
Well,
want
cool. Yeah, I'm sure there's so much more, right? It's like so hard to introduce oneself. That's like Diane's little nutshell moment. What about Miss Charlotte?
to? So I'm also Bahamian, born in Nassau, but I grew up in Hong Kong after independence here. Although my mother's Bahamian, my father's British, and a lot of the pilots at Bahamas Air effectively lost their jobs, the foreign pilots, and were given jobs in Hong Kong. So we moved en masse, foreign pilots married to Bahamian women.
Wow.
And there is a book about that.
Hey.
Yeah, the history of Bahamas Air.
Oh, whoa. We'll have to put that in the show notes.
Yeah, there's some cool photos. So I came home once or twice a year throughout my childhood, as all my family was still here. And eventually I lived all over the world, but I eventually ended up living back in Hong Kong in banking. And the bank I was working at was physically next to the World Wildlife Fund. And I ended up being drawn into the office of the WWF and volunteering and working with the pink dolphins that were highly threatened in Hong Kong. And began a sort of love affair with marine mammals and with becoming a scientist. At that time, I was a computer programmer. So there was some overlap with the scientific interest. And then it became, how can I do this and move back home to the Bahamas? Which gradually I was able to do.
Thank
You're
you.
welcome.
Bye, Riley.
She couldn't handle the sadness of the pink dolphin.
No.
I know. Wow, Hong Kong. See, I didn't even know that.
Yeah, Hong Kong to
Didn't think
Sandy
that about
Point.
you. Yeah, she moved from Hong Kong to Sandy Point.
That's a really big shift
Yeah,
energetically, I
it took
could
me
imagine.
about 2 years to get the speed down.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, the
Wow.
commute to work. Well, when Charlotte first moved here, she was living in a rental house down the beach, and the commute to work was a I either walked down the beach, but she usually arrived by swimming here.
Oh, wow.
And
That's
then
fantastic.
I got out the water. I didn't have an earache.
Yeah, the water was clean.
Oh, so you swam in Hong Kong a lot.
Yeah, I would rather swim and put eardrops in than not swim.
Wow. Whoa. So like you would open water swim in Hong Kong, and like you're saying that the pollution is so much that it was
Yeah.
ouchy years.
Yeah. I didn't know that wasn't normal.
Wow, that's amazing. And so you find yourself. So wait, and you both went to the same university.
Yeah, that was later.
Oh, this is
But
later.
we both independently went to universities in Scotland.
Like without knowing that you were both going to do that.
Yeah, without knowing.
Without knowing, yeah.
Wow, that's
Yeah, I
wild.
did my master's at University of Aberdeen, and Charlotte did hers at University of St. Andrews. And then we both did our.
What brings you to Scott? Like, how did you both like? I find that interesting. What do I not know?
Well,
What am
Charlotte's story, as usual, Charlotte's story is a lot more interesting than mine.
I?
More lively. But no, mine was that the UK, well, I was colleagues that were working here actually. They had started out as volunteers, and one of them, actually both of them, ended up at Aberdeen and did their PhDs at Aberdeen. And some of their work included studies here in the Bahamas. So, and I mean, I knew them when they were before all of that, but through them, then I was introduced to the fact that in the UK, the university system is quite different, and for continuing education in particular, where you can a foreign student can stay in your home country, be registered student at a university, but continue working, which was important for me to stay home and work, and do a research degree, basically.
Wow.
You didn't have to take classes if you had the knowledge already or had
Right.
means to gain the knowledge in other ways to produce a thesis. You know, it was all about producing a thesis. And so that brings the cost down hugely, right? And the time in the US and in North America and even Europe, that's, or continental Europe, that's not the same. So that's why Scotland worked for me.
Wow, that's amazing.
And for me, the woman who ran the WWF, Dr. Lindsay Porter, well, she's Scottish, but she encouraged me to come on a sabbatical. So I took a month off of work and went on a marine mammal survey into the Timor Sea, which was with WWF Malaysia and Australia as well. And it was an amazing experience. But during that survey, we used a hydrophone to listen for marine mammals, and I'd never experienced that, and that I was immediately drawn to that aspect of the research more so than taking photos or using the binoculars. You know, that was my kind of trigger. I'm really interested in how this works. And then she advised me to come to a marine mammal conference with her and meet people. So I had a good job, and leaving that job was, I had to make a lot of decisions. So I went to the conference and I met acousticians, people who study marine mammal sounds. And they advised me that as a computer programmer, that transition would be quite easy.
Totally.
And also that at the time, the UK were giving grants to people in mathematical fields like programming or traditional maths to study science, because they were finding a lot of scientists doing field work and they're not able to analyze the data. So they were giving people money to study. And they said you would easily be able to get that grant. And a lot of those people were from the same university and said they would sponsor me. And so that's how I ended up at St. Andrews.
That's so neat. Oh my gosh. I'm smirking a little bit because there was this guy who was in what is this called? He worked for GE, and it was he did vibration analysis. And this was when I was kind of in cahoots with James Nestor and Fabrice Nollet and Fred Bouilly, that were doing all this like acoustic research on sperm whales. And this guy, he was like, I mean, I'm an engineer. Like, what kind of role could I have in this? And I was like, are you not hearing who you are and what you do? Like, you're a vibration analysis specialist. Like, these couldn't go more hand in hand, right? So I love that tie together. So I want to go back to the history or the creation of BIMRO itself, because I nerded out on your website quite a bit, and but 31 years is a very long time for an organization to be around. So if you could talk about that would be wonderful.
Yeah, well, I when I I returned to the Bahamas in 1991. And I was had been working with a group in the in Washington State in the Pacific Northwest that was studying primarily killer whales, the southern resident killer whale population there. And that work at the time was funded primarily through a grant from Earthwatch Institute. And so paying participants contributed towards the cost of conducting the field work. And in exchange for that, they were able to join the science team in the field. So coming home, the initial idea of getting funding was perhaps seeing if Earthwatch would be interested in funding work here too. And we ended up in Abaca because there had been a capture operation of bottlenose dolphins for a touristic facility here. There was some concern from local residents as to it wasn't just about the dolphins because they dynamited some of the barrier reef system and, you know, were dredging in seagrass beds and a lot of really negative impacts on the marine environment. But yeah, sort of like the nail in the coffin for the locals concerned about this was they went out and captured 10 bottlenose dolphins from the area. But nobody had any idea how many dolphins were here and whether, you know, if you remove those 10, another 10 would arrive, or, you know, what that would mean. And so from a research perspective, it was kind of a we had a question to answer immediately, and that's why we ended up basing in Abaco, and the initial project was assessing the abundance of bottlenose dolphins in that part of Abaco, in the Sea of Abaco. And so yeah, originally funded by Earthwatch, and the work here was under the umbrella of the research group in Washington State.
Wow, that's so cool.
Yeah. And then the other part of the origin of the organization was that we knew from stranding records in the Bahamas that there were this group of cetaceans, whales that are deep divers that's very, very little known. And I mean, at that time, most of the species had never even been seen alive. They've
Oh,
just,
right. This is the Blainesville.
yeah, Blainesvilles, Cuviers, and which are no longer called Cuvier because he was not a good person. They're now called Goosebeaked, or they've reverted back to one of their original names, common names, and Gervais beaked whales. There's three species that are known from the Bahamas. And in the stranding record, you know, when I was returning home, I was delved into all of the published information on marine mammals occurrence in the country, and it was almost entirely from stranding records. And the beaked whales formed much of that, those strandings. So it was like, wow, this is a seems to be something here that's providing good habitat for beaked whales. Yeah, as it turns out, we're absolutely right. And you know, the Bahamas is, a lot of people think of the clear water and the reefs and, you know, corals and mangroves and beautiful beaches, and we do have all of that, but we also have very, very deep water and deep water canyons and troughs and basins that surround the shallow banks, and those provide habitat for these deep diving animals. But the key to our success in studying them was that deep water is very close to shore. Like in the US, on the eastern coast of the US, to get out to water depths that deep, in most places you have to go a couple hundred miles offshore, you know, and you need big boats and costs a lot of money. And we could literally use, you know, 15-foot inflatable and get out there and find beaked whales
But also
and
then
learn something about them for the first time.
you applied the same method you'd use with killer whales of photo ID for the first time, right? To beaked whales.
Well, for that species anyway, for any of the mesoplodon beaked whales. And yeah, so we, you know, the killer whale work for years already had been established. They had established that you could recognize individuals, and the same was true for humpback whales. in the early days, when we, you know, when scientists learned that you didn't have to kill a whale to learn about its biology.
Right.
And a lot of aspects of its biology. I mean, there is more that you can learn if you have the entire carcass there, but then it's gone. You know, that's a dead
one. Right. It's also dead, which is a total, you know, like.
Not much about its behavior.
No, nothing about it.
Right.
But yeah, with the early killer whale work that started in the early 1970s, when those populations in the Northwest were being targeted for captive operations. They removed half of the whales out there.
Whoa, why?
Because people, well, they were thrilling
for
to
captivity.
See, yeah, thrilling to see an aquarium.
You know, it's interesting. It's like, I guess, like subconsciously in this weird way, I've been preparing for this conversation by watching the movie Flipper and the Free Willy with our son, Wolfie. And I mean, and I remember like Damien, my husband, he's had a lot of like really big impactful moments in my life. And one of these impactful moments was when he like sort of spilled the beans, like, you know, isn't it like super fucked up that like they made this story about freeing Willie, but like I don't think they freed Willie.
Yeah.
And he told me this like probably 15 years ago, and I was just like, I mean, I cried, I like slammed the door, I was like, you ruined my life. Well, I mean, there really is something to that, right? And yeah. And then the incredible film, the most, you know, The Cove, right? So like sort of like, the uncovering of really the truth of all of so much of the horror that it is to put an animal like that in captivity.
And Blackfish is another.
Oh, I guess it's both. Oh, it's Blackfish.
The Cove is about the
dolphins.
Yeah, the
it's like a mass.
Yeah, the Japanese, the Taiji.
Okay, so you're right. I am referring to Blackfish.
Yeah, Blackfish. Yeah.
Blackfish
yeah.
is when you really learn.
In the Cove.
But the Cove is horrific as well.
They do allow for you know, the future. So they interview some young Japanese who are now doing whale watching, whose fathers were involved in the atrocities, you know. So,
right. Yeah. Of course. I mean, there's both and to everything. I am like such a both ander. This is not a slander of any of those films or even
but
any of
but the captive industry was involved partly involved and partly responsible for the slaughters as well. I mean,
yes.
I think it would have happened anyway, but
right.
there, you know, there was really good evidence of the captive industry when during the dry fishery, if they brought in like Risso's dolphins or, you know, a species that weren't, no other aquarium had them on display, then the captive industry would come there and buy them.
Yeah.
And they would go, you know, like, we saved them,
but
because you're paying for them, they're actually, you know, participating in the in the problem.
Yeah,
right.
So it's a tie back to captive industry.
The tie back, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, and it's important, I think, just the both end, because there is almost like, I mean, in my bedroom, okay, I have a photograph, and maybe I'll put it in here somehow, but like, it's a photograph that my British nanny, who you very much remind me of, Charlotte, she now lives in Florida. We all lived in Florida for a long period of time in my life, but she just happened to be like out on their 15-foot, you know, inflatable, and dropped in a camera. And this was probably 30 years ago. So the quality, I think it was a throwaway underwater, like, remember those that like Kodak made or something? But she just stuck her hand down and snapped a picture. It's the most beautiful photograph of a mama and a baby dolphin. It is on my wall and it has been everywhere I've lived.
Nice.
And like, you know, there's something, and actually another funny thing, because it's Halloween tomorrow. The last Halloween that I spent as a maiden, In New Orleans, pre-Wolfie, I was a dolphin trainer.
Oh,
I wore like a
for
full
Halloween. I was like, Di
dress
was Di was about to
suit.
slam the lid.
Oh, dolphin. I know, I do know dolphins. We do know dolphin trainers, yeah.
Well, and but the thing is it's just like it's a forever love, but it's a forever love that I feel like me and like pretty much everyone else shares. You know, like if you're honest with yourself, like everybody loves dolphins, you
But
know?
how, what is it, how do you dress up as a dolphin trainer? How was it obvious?
I mean, I really like I wore a wetsuit that was like quite dated. It was like
You have a bucket
I didn't have a bucket of fish, but
of fish?
I had a whistle. Like I would like the whistle
Oh,
was really a part of it. And like I had like water booties on. I mean, I was full on like ready to go and play. And yeah, it was my favorite costume actually. There's nothing grim about it. I actually am like the Scrooge of Halloween. I hate Halloween. But I dress as a dolphin trainer. But the point that I'm trying to like get back into is just that inside of everyone and inside of all of our listeners is like a little child who loves dolphins, right? Like it's a real thing. And so the importance, I think, of, you know, learning the story, like in Blackfish, I think it's Blackfish, but now I'm like doing this dance because it's the gentleman who was responsible for training Flipper.
Oh, Rick O'Barry.
Thank you, Rick O'Barry, and how he tells the story of his beloved dolphin literally committing suicide by choosing not to breathe again in his arms.
Right.
Because of his level of like misery of basically being a slave to like being a captive dolphin. And just how like really riveting that is, you know, and how like that, if you haven't seen the film for the listeners, like it's worth watching The Cove and Blackfish, like it, because it's worth thinking about. And when when we are, you know, we have all these messages coming from like you know, the David Attenboroughs of the world, and that like the time is now, like, and the time may even have been like 30 years ago, like when we really needed to do something about protecting our planet and protecting our marine life. So I think it's important for us and for the listeners to kind of nestle into this reality, because what we're talking about here, the three of us, is we're talking about a specific group of dolphins that we're asking for help with, and we're asking for support of, and like, so why, you know, is the Sea of Abaco, like, to bring it back, why are the Sea of Abaco population of dolphins so important, you know? Why is any group of anything so important? And if and since you all have spent, you know, the better part of 30 years looking at that, can you share with us some about this specific Sea of Abaco dolphin?
Well, I think, there's factual reasons and then there's emotional, right? And we definitely, I guess you haven't been here since the storm, but it's
I
it's
have actually. I have been one time post-storm.
okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I think even as hurricanes are approaching now, years later, people, it triggers trauma and people are still traumatized. And having the dolphins in the Sea of Abaco that you can see on your ferry ride to work is emotionally stabilizing.
Yeah,
There's
the
normality,
world is okay. The world is a good place.
and I think that's a valid point in this community. But factually, dolphins are megafauna. They are a key indicator species. If there are dolphins and they're doing okay, you need to monitor them to know they're doing okay. That means that pretty much everything under them is doing okay. And that's really important for a community that fishes, a community that sports tourism, that snorkels reefs, and would expect the reefs and the fish on the reefs to be vibrant and healthy. If you monitor dolphins and something starts going wrong, you can pretty much bet that that's going to trickle down. So that, it's really important for economy as well as well-being.
Right.
Absolutely.
And it
But
was.
then it also circles back nicely to how BIMRO began, the Sea of Abaco dolphins.
Yeah, totally. Well, that's why we became based here in Abaco because of those dolphins. And did some initial population estimates and learned very quickly that the dolphins were resident. So when you go out on the water, you see the same dolphins that you might have seen. One of an animal, an adult female, with another adult female 2 weeks ago, and today she's with somebody else. And a couple of months later, she has a calf, and then you monitor the calf status. And within a few decades, the calves are having calves, and you're 3 generations in, and that's kind of where we are now. And it
And keep.
was like Charlotte saying about the importance. Emotionally, that these animals play and the role that they play in our lives. And after the hurricane, to get out on the water and see dolphins that I have known since the early 1990s, and to see that they're okay, I mean, that was just huge, to understand that, yeah, this was horrific. And I'm not downplaying it at all, but the fact that they made it, or some of them made it anyway, just
Yeah.
made me feel like things might be okay.
Yeah. And what's interesting is I like to believe that emotional connection is actually like a heightened sense of awareness that we as human beings have, right? Because it's like, why else would it give you this like sort of warm blanket of comfort, but that your deep psyche actually knows that, like, this is a top predator, this is a top species, and if it is healthy, pretty much everything underneath it can be. Like I see this like really beautiful interplay between the emotional and the reality. Like I see them being really one. Well, yeah, thank you for sharing that. And I'm wondering, I have some of these numbers written down, statistical wise, just because I think it's important for the listeners to hear. Back in the 80s, it's the numbers are between like 89 local population, or maybe even prior to that, being around 149 dolphin. Is that proper?
Well, we did our first estimate in 1994, and it was around 89, but the methods and computational capabilities have advanced a lot more since then. And they weren't, it was in the ballpark for sure. And then more recent estimates later in the 1990s were around 50 animals, and then just declining since the region's been hit by multiple hurricanes repeatedly. That seems to be the major impact that these local resident populations can't seem to recover from. And so our response to that is to try to make the decrease the impacts, other impacts that we know are affecting them as well. They're require us to change our behavior here, whereas with climate change, there's not that much that in the Bahamas we can do differently that's going to bring the global
Emissions down.
temperatures down, keep them down to where we're all not going to drown. But there are other things that we can do here that will help build resilience in local populations. And one of those things, the easiest thing is to slow boats down, because some of the work that's done and her students have done have shown that Boat traffic is noise from boats is it's loud enough in the Sea of Abaco to keep dolphins away from certain areas that may be important places for them to be in order to carry out their normal life functions like feeding and
Yeah,
socializing.
absolutely. And one of the Diane and Charlotte graciously shared with me this really incredible Sea of Abaco dolphin recovery plan, which is 67 pages of pure magic. Cannot tell you how like I was like, my life is complete. Like I am reading a real life marine biological study for dolphins. Like I literally, like I cried. I mean, whatever. But so as I was like, one of my favorite pulls from reading that is that 56% of their behavior changed. And I was wondering if you could speak to that specific little fact that I pulled. But then the other one that I like too is that all you're asking for is 1.4 knots to pull back speed. 1.4 knots. This is what, like 5 miles per hour?
Not even, yeah.
Oh.
But I think that's mixing two things up.
Yeah. So this basically the speed of boats is an easy thing to manage, right?
Right.
And it is the key driver in noise pollution. So
Right.
the slower boats go, the less noise they make. There's other
Right.
aspects like the cleaner their propeller is, the less noise they make, the newer their propeller is, how loaded the boat is. There are other aspects, but something everyone can relate to is, well, if you just pull back on the throttle,
Yeah.
the exact, like the sweet spot of speed is, like even lower than 20 knots is going to be beneficial. And
Yeah.
it exists in other places. There are places in Spain where an entire body of water has a speed limit, similar to we have on roads. So
Yeah.
it's not a crazy idea. It wouldn't affect anyone locally. The ferries don't go faster than 20 knots. The boats that are carrying freight, anything locally, it wouldn't affect. It would only affect tourists in high speed boats. So,
Well, and locals at high speed.
and
It
locals
wouldn't
in high
affect
speed boat, you're
anything commercially.
right, exactly. Yeah. So, the message there is, well, just try and enjoy the journey, right?
Totally. I mean, that's why I'm like chuckling over here because it's such a metaphor for life, right? It's just slow the fuck down, you know?
Slow down and enjoy.
It's like, but yeah, I mean, 37% the noise level drop. That was the number that I loved. It was like, if you just pull back the throttle, I mean, 37% of a noise drop is significant. Like, that's
So
huge.
that was a study that we did down here that affects the sperm whales. And that study was like most COVID studies, serendipitous. We had baseline data. And then partly because of the rules that came out in this country, we couldn't go and pick up our recorder. So we ended up getting COVID data as well. And we were able then to suggest to government what we had hypothesized we would suggest. We think slowing boats down will affect the ocean noise significantly. How could you know that? And then in COVID, all the boats slowed down. So we could say, we know if the boats slow down by this much, this is what will happen. We know that because it happened in COVID. So now we recommend doing that. And the government are looking at that proposal as well as the Sea of Abaco proposal. The Sea of Abaco may be more of a guideline, but it's a guideline that if you market it well, and there can be some shaming, right? Don't you love dolphins? Whatever. I'm not a marketing person, but If we market that well and all Bahamians take it on board, and everyone, no, there's no one going super fast in certain areas, it's not a big area.
Totally.
I think tourists are really attracted to countries that are proud of their resources. And I think they would then slow down.
Yeah, and I mean, Charlotte's throwing out this 20 knots.
I mean,
It's not necessarily 20, it could be 25 knots, you know. It just
we don't know the exact sweet spot.
there are more and more boats that are just going faster and faster, and you know, fancy boats with four or five engines, big engines on the stern, and you know, they can go 60, 70 knots, and they do, and it's crazy. You know, they're running over turtles. We don't have an incident of a dolphin being run over,
They're hitting
we've
turtles.
certainly seen them scared when those boats are approaching. And yeah, and you know, people are going to get injured. There's no question about that. You just can't keep adding the more and more boats to an area going faster and faster. And at some point, there's got to be some limit, right? And we're just suggesting that we call that limit before we trash things completely. And it will make a huge difference for dolphins using the area, you know. And we know that the dolphins are, well, we don't know, but similarly during COVID, we gained an understanding of what happens in that area when there are no boats there, because the boating traffic in the Sea of Africa was shut down. And
So beautiful.
yeah, and so, you know, the prior to that, dolphins weren't using the area very, very much at all. Turn the boats off,
Well,
dolphins start returning to the area.
it started in Dorian. So after Dorian, we put the recorders out, and gradually we were detecting more and more dolphins. And then COVID happened, and well, no, then the rebuild started. So lots of freight boats bringing supplies to rebuild houses.
Well, and the recovery, you know, like help arrived.
The dolphin detections reduced as that boat noise increased. And then COVID happened, and a lot of the volunteer groups had to leave, who were helping with rebuilding. And so the ocean went quiet again, and the dolphins came back again. So there's this direct correlation with noise.
And for listeners who might not be totally privy, like, so Dorian was only what, like 5 months maybe before COVID?
It's September 1st, and we had our first restrictions here March 19th, 6 months later.
6 months, right? So yeah, I remember. Oh my gosh. Wow.
Yeah, and in the Bahamas, our prime minister at the time was a medical doctor, and he shut us down. You know, like each island was shut down. There was no movement between, so yeah.
What was that experience like, from just like a life perspective? I mean, having
Was,
like
I
Dor
think
so
it
you
was,
get hit by Dorian and then you
yeah.
get hit by COVID. I mean, that just more out like more for the morale or morally, how did you survive that?
Well, I think even people whose houses were destroyed, I can't speak for them. For us, our house wasn't destroyed. And I just felt so lucky compared to people in cities and who didn't have access to nature, basically. I still feel lucky for
But
that.
I mean, for the people who had lost their house in Hurricane Dorian, you know, just 30 miles away from us, they're living in tents. They've got infants. They're being told that, you know, you need to sanitize. They don't have running water. I mean, it was definitely a slap in the face for those people,
Well,
and
and
horrific. And you know, and that, you know, that wasn't our personal experience, but you're aware and you're feeling it. And people were dying, you know. Bahamians, we have our population is ha has a lot of issues with comorbidities, and you know, because of some of the religious beliefs and you know, being given ill advice about what the appropriate responses were and what you should and shouldn't do, despite the government, you know, doing the right thing.
And having limited medical resources.
Yes,
You know,
right.
not every island has a hospital. In fact,
Yeah.
pretty much only two have.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you got COVID, then the response was to fly you to Nassau, but that was in what it was called a pod, so like
A bag
a
thing.
bag basically.
Whoa.
Put this bag over you that, you know, obviously was aerated and everything, but where they could control the environment and not expose everybody on the plane.
But the pod was quite small compared to Bahamians.
Yeah.
Wow.
So there was that limit.
So there was nothing, you know, it was really bad. It's
It
really
was,
bad. I mean, we
yeah.
lost friends and people we know.
Wow. Yeah, I remember thinking about a lot about you all, you know, in the midst of that, just being like, wow, like all of every, like so much of the infrastructure was destroyed just like yesterday. And
Yeah.
then, you know, like then these beautiful efforts, and then the, everything just got squashed again. And then that strange silence, which, you know, and it which is so interesting, the both and, right? Because, and also like as scientists and also these people who are so hyper aware of the natural world all the time. I mean, I was like stoked for the natural world, you
Yeah.
know,
Yeah.
stoked for all the quiet and for like all the planes being grounded and all the cars. And
Yeah.
she can come join anytime. Come to me, baby. Oh, goodness. Oh, my goodness.
Hi, Ryan. We have we did a video that's called the anthropause, which was a term by one of the scientists early on who wrote a paper about the quiet. And we did a video about that as well.
Really? Oh, wow. I would like to link that in the show notes. The anthropause. What a beautiful word. Well, and you know, we can't leave this conversation without also talking about the fact that this is a love story. Bimro is a love story. You have to give us some of that, right? You all are in love. You fell in love on research on a boat.
It happens.
It was the swimming to work that got me. But
Right?
I love
Daryl Hannah, like every day, you're like, stop.
No, was just the knowing that there's somebody else that loves the water that much and wants to begin her day by getting in the sea. In fact, you did it this morning
Every morning.
too.
Every morning.
Yeah, I was a and I came as an intern, and the first time I met Di in person, I was home for Christmas, and my grandmother came with me to go to the island. I was with her family for Christmas,
In
so
Eleuthera.
we were in Nassau, and we caught the ferry, and I met Di and her family, and talked about coming the next year to do an internship. And when I came in July, that six only 6 months later, I was completely surprised because I remember I remember her as being about somewhere between 6 foot 2 and 6 foot 4, and she's like 5 foot 4. And I think that was the beginning, right? You know, when you see someone literally bigger than they are.
I actually would think the same thing. You do have a very big, intense presence, but also like mad, like amazingly loving and caring. And yeah,
Just a tiny little
just
thing.
a little thing.
Just a little 5 foot 4.
Well, not quite.
You're 5 foot 4, right, on a good day with your
Starts
arm.
being kind, yeah. In Bahamian, you call it shortness.
Shortness.
I got shortness.
I have shortness also.
Yeah.
have a whole, yeah, like 5'1", but that's why. Tapping the ridiculous, I don't even know if you can call it a bun on the top of my head. And y'all got married.
Yeah, we got
Yes,
married.
yeah. So that was 20 years ago when
No
we
way. Oh my God.
yeah 2004.
this year, yeah. And then we got married in 2016. Yeah.
Wow. On island, on like in the Abacos or where?
Well, we're legally married in Canada because
Oh.
Bahamas doesn't recognize same-sex marriages.
Yeah.
And we did want it to
You
be
always have to
legal.
say yet
Yes,
to give promise.
yes.
Yet.
I think we will get there.
I think we'll get there.
Think we will get there. Not too
But
distant future.
we had the party and the wedding here and did our vows and wore wedding dresses and it was great.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so
And
beautiful.
the lady from the WWF was at the
Yeah.
wedding.
And other
Oh,
friends from
and
St.
other
Andrews,
friends.
Aberdeen,
Yeah, lots of
and
scientists. Yeah.
did you have any scientists from the, was that like the PNW scientists from the Killer Whales times?
Okay. No,
No.
they didn't. They couldn't come, but
Yeah.
they're still in our lives. Yeah.
They're in spirit. That is so beautiful. And I'm wondering, what does it look like to paint the picture for the ideal? Well, we actually kind of, I mean, we kind of talked about that, but no, I mean, so ideally, in a totally idyllic world, what does like the pause picture look like in the Sea of Abaco? If you were to ask, like, not just slow your roll as far as driving, but what are a couple of, are there other things that can be done in the Sea of Abaco? Like I just want to say that when I've been thinking about all of this and reading, you know, the big proposal, and you know, I was just like, wow, like it seems like dolphins, like this research could kind of tip, like be a tipping point. I think name famous book, right? Where all of the sudden ecotourism is just happening. It's like the seed gets planted and then the growth is just exponential, because once you do, physically and metaphorically speaking, slow down, and you're doing it because of the dolphins. Do you like how can you not see then the turtles and birds, you know, and frigates, and you know, like how can you not start to notice? So it's like this gift, right? Would be like this the beginning implementation of asking both the tourists and the locals to like see more, right?
Yeah, and when you start seeing more, then you understand, you know, in seeing more, you might notice that this area, there's a lot of turtles there. And gosh, that's a wonderful thing. And over here, there aren't as many. So, you know, what's special about this area? You know, it spurs an interest and your, you know, natural curiosity. And in a lot of ways, that can drive conservation as well. And, but like specifically for the dolphin, sort of the ideal pause for dolphins would, I think it also needs to include, well, one of the things that came out of the producing the recovery plan is the addressing the need for up-to-date information on the areas that are most important to dolphins. So doing some in years past, we did line transect surveys throughout the entire Sea of Abaco, and so we knew then which areas were important habitat to dolphins, and we really need to repeat that, and so that we're driving the conservation by science, and you know, making advice that's based on science and recent science and sensible and.
Yeah, having the funds to regularly monitor the population, increase the accessibility of our technology that citizen scientists can contribute sightings. Maybe there are areas that we'll find that are actually no-go zones, but we don't know that.
Yeah.
Helping the fairies to understand, like, can you clean your prop every 3 months? You know, there's so many things that can be done with time and resources, basically.
Yeah. And you know, we know there's the interest there in doing that, from all stakeholders. I mean, the fairies have been the first recorders we put out after Dorian. We used a fairy to do that, and so every time we go and are checking those recorders, the fairies are aware of the work that we're doing. And
And that's what I love about like podcast formats and things like this, where it, 'cause what it's doing is it's bringing us together, right? It's like you all aren't just the scientists over there in your like brilliance and everything that you know, and like we're just the sort of layman, like being like, doo, 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 well, I got, it like it ties us together. It brings us together, and it brings a greater understanding of, because of course, like we all want the same thing, right? Like we all want a thriving planet where like Riley and her little friends all also get to see dolphins, and also get to experience just, an existence of life that's thriving.
And the baby dolphins, you know,
They want that too.
in the Sea of Abaco today also have their
They want to
offspring.
see Riley.
Yeah, that's right.
My God, it's
But I think also, you know, in bringing the vision of the dolphin recovery plan to Abaco and people who live here in particular, it also highlights the, well, I think through doing that, we will also have the potential to look at prey resources and you know, the pressure on those resources from overfishing and address some of these issues that we talk about all the time, but nothing ever happens. You know, the government is underfunded and they're not doing enough to even enforce the, you know, the fisheries laws that we have and regulations and just yeah, helping people understand why that's important and you know, having a healthy ecosystem.
I mean, that's like, I think I have to invite you back for a round two, because there's so many questions and there's so many, like, I mean, Damien and I talk about it all the time, like coastal people who live on islands or on the coast, like, I mean, it's sort of like, it's like, seems like a nature's right, for y'all to get to consume fruits of the sea. But for those of us inland, like, me, like, even what if it was like every other year, like we get to send, we get to have seafood like inland, or you know what I mean? Like, I know that's a big thing, but like, what if, and then, but like for fishermen, for people who are making their living off of that, what if for those on those off years, they were actually working with you all? Like, if all of these people who have access to water and, years and years of knowledge about, what the fish are doing and how the weather affects the patterns and how the seasons affects them and all of this, like, what if there could be that citizen scientist aspect, but it would have to be funded, right? Like, they would need to make money in the absence of selling their fish to whatever. And so, yeah, I would love to have, like, because those are those real ideal conversations that, like, I think we're afraid to maybe have, but like, would that look like? And I think it's going to take some big conversations to get big changes like that to happen.
Yeah, I mean, right now the Bahamas is we really need a closed season on conch. We know that conch are being harvested before they're mature, before they're sexually mature, and that populations are declining. And you know, and we're one of the only countries in the world where we still have populations that are large enough to, you know, to sustain some level of removals for human consumption. And but in order to keep that going, we know that we need to close the season. So at least during the breeding season, conch have a chance to reproduce. And but the yeah, politically not ready for that conversation. It just And it's because of the short-sightedness of,
That's all politicians globally.
But you can't do conservation in the short term.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, fishermen are, the fisheries are a resource that's available to everybody. And not everywhere. I mean, I know there's some places where you can only take lobster if you have a license, and the licenses are only issued to so many people. But here, if I don't take that lobster
Undersized.
undersized, then the next person will. So I might as well take it. And it's that mentality. And like the fishermen aren't thinking about the long term either.
But and the truth is like it will run out.
It will run out.
Yeah, well, it is, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when my dad was a kid, they could get conch out of Nassau Harbor. I mean, when there's people alive here in Abaco that would get conch out of Marsh Harbor, and Sandy Point. Oh my gosh, where we lived,
Yeah.
you didn't even need a boat to get
And
them.
it's not like that anymore.
Well, you can still do that, but they're all undersized. They're all immature. They're all baby conch.
Baby come.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that was one of the questions I wanted to ask y'all about. I mean, I just remember like there being traps, right? Like people setting traps. Now I'm talking more about like crawfish or Caribbean lobster. Like what? Those are babies. Like the people would like, these lobster wouldn't come to full maturity. But then at the same time, I was literally just thinking about this lying in bed the other night, thinking like, okay, well, if is it actually better like to have traps and to then like so that the crawfish that are like populating the actual reefs aren't getting killed? I mean, would that almost be like what is that? It would almost be like a farming kind of a process, but like naturally.
Yeah, I mean the big move with setting traps, and I mean people have been using traps for a long time, but I think you're talking about like the shelters, the habitats they're called, the
Shelters, I'm
condominiums.
talking about. Yes.
The big move there was to get the fishermen, get the lobsters off the reefs, get the fishermen off the reefs, because the fishermen were
Ah.
damaging the reefs, the fishing methods they were using were damaging the
So
reefs.
that was what it was originally for.
Yeah, I mean that was part of it. They're a lot easier to harvest if they're under
Right.
a metal shelter rather than having to scurry around the reef
Right.
and theoretically you can be more careful in your harvesting and make sure that you only actually catch the ones that are mature, so you're more selective. Whereas in a reef, if it's back under a ledge, then you don't necessarily have that the ability to see the animal as much. So yeah,
Right.
there's some good reasons. And we do still see lobster on reefs.
Yeah.
For sure. I mean, well, and then, but then another question on maturity is like, isn't it also smart to leave some of the sexually mature because like they're the ones that are reproducing? You know, it's like, so I mean, it's really almost just like
In some
slow
countries,
control.
yeah, in some countries, for certain species, the regulations, you can't take the immature small ones, but you also can't take the old, huge ones, because those are the ones that are, have shown that they, whatever their secret is, they've evaded capture all those years. So, yeah, they're
Like the super breeders.
the best.
Yeah.
They're the ones
Yeah.
to keep.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So I guess
Yeah, we're a little off topic. I mean, not entirely,
not entirely. Well, because I'm thinking about like because the question of like what does like this sort of ideal, what does the ideal picture look like? And I guess because I'm, a tourist, like I am someone who yearns to be a native, a local of Abaco, but I'm not. And so like how to be a healthy tourist, you know? I mean, I feel like I can answer my own question. And it's what I've always thought about since I was little is like just point and shoot with a camera.
Yeah.
And
Yeah,
like, you
I mean,
know.
my vision of like a perfect sea of Abaco would be ecosystems intact, you know, the seagrass beds and reefs and mangroves not being damaged by development and dug out for marinas and
Sure, golf course runoff.
golf courses. And, you know, recognizing that it's a beautiful place, but not everybody's going to be able to see it. You know, there has to be a limit of the number of people that can access these parts of the world. And I don't mean that, you know, just there for the rich and famous or whatever, but there has to be a limit to how many boats are on the water. And yeah, and the people that are on the water, well, and from, you know, the local perspective, there's healthy fish populations, and so the fishermen are making a living fishing, and they understand why it's important to have regulations, and are engaged in that conversation. And for the tourists that, you know, and Bahamas is also making money because of the fact that it is a pristine place that has recovered, and you know, there's lots of fish and turtles and rays and sharks and dolphins, of course. And they take tourists there, or they're on their own boats there, and they respect them. You know, they don't want to feed everything that they see and touch everything that they see, that they appreciate that, you know, these are living animals that have their own lives and their own needs, and us interfering with them is not what they need at all. So, yeah.
Right. I know, I love that. And I love what you said that you know, the baby dolphins want to see Riley. You know, like
Yeah.
it's not just think about my baby dolphin. I have to, you know, it's like it's thinking about them from their perspective. And I think that's just always such a it's just such a it's what these like long conversations get to do, right? Is like the listeners really get to learn that like there are people with hearts and love stories and, you know, living in freaking China. Like, I mean, I had no idea about this about you all. And it's just like, you know, how when we just get to really slow down and notice each other, like, well, of course we want to help. Of course we want to learn more and give grace, you know, to what has already been working so well, which is, you know, which is the natural world.
Right.
You know, one thing, like, I feel like it's a good place to kind of tie it all in because I know you all have to travel tomorrow and you must go. But, you know, when we had our first conversation when Damien was here and he asked, like, just the most beautiful question was, what do you need to do what y'all do? And your answer was passion. And I just love that. Like, I just wanted to bring that in to this conversation and invite your passion stories. Like, you know, like what maybe is your most passionate moment of being in this work and being with these animals, maybe specifically the dolphins of Abaco or maybe something else, but just like, and I'm sure you have many, many moments.
Well,
Like,
I think there are, you know, the sort of amazing times with the animals. And luckily we've had many, you know, looking whales in the eye and, you know, drifting off, and instead of looking out to sea, just looking down and a whale being right there. And you know, so many opportunities, but we've also had young Bahamians who, you know, we might not recognize at first, but come up to us and tell us that they've changed their lives. We've changed their lives, you know, that going to whale camp literally changed their lives. And they now work in environmental groups in the Bahamas, and just that you're any part of that is quite meaningful. We're lacking scientists, so if we can help in any way change that, that's pretty powerful. When I first met Di and saw her like passion for marine mammals, I asked her if you could save 20 whales or 20 humans, what would you do? And she said, I'd save the humans because one human could save 2,000 whales. So.
I'm not sure I believe that today.
Oh yeah, I do. That's what this podcast is all about.
No, I'm only joking. The world's changed a lot in the last 20 years, but but it doesn't mean it can't change for the better.
There are still good humans.
There's a lot of good humans, yes.
Yeah, there really is. Oh.
Yeah, I mean, and I would just add that, I feel very privileged to have had the chance to get to know some of these individual dolphins and whales, and the dolphins mostly, because we have more, because they're in shallow water, we have more opportunity to get out there and be on the water with them. But they are individuals, and they have their own characters, and they have their own social units, and we kind of always joke of, we recognize them from their natural markings and nicks and scratches and stuff, but do they recognize us? Do they know it's us when we're approaching an animal to get its ID photo? And yeah,
Of course they do.
I think they do.
Oh, of course they do. I actually, I'm having this like crazy flashback. So I'm from New Orleans, but I grew up on we had a house in a nature preserve on the panhandle of Florida. And it was really unique. It was, like to the if you were standing on the at like on the porch of the house looking at the Gulf of Mexico, to the right was just like humans. Like lots of humans. And of course, when I was little, there was not very many, but through my life, there became much more. But then to the left or to the east was a full nature preserve. And it was for what felt like hundreds of miles, which was actually more like probably like maybe 60 miles. Yeah, big. And my dad would force us out of bed at 6 a.m. Come on, let's go. And we had these two little Yamaha wave runners, like tiny old school early 90s, and we would get these boats in the water and we would just cruise down into the sun, like into the rising sun. And so you actually like couldn't see anything through the water going, and I'm like still sleeping but just like it's like flat calm gorgeous. And then you turn around like right before the next swath of humanity. And the sun was backlighting. So as you know, I mean, and this water was almost as blue as the Bahamas. Like, I mean, it's unbelievable. And we would spend the better part of the next 3 to 5 hours just finding dolphins and sharks and turtles and rays of all different kinds, like different seasons, like at the end of the summer were the manta rays. And oh my God, it was just on like the t schools of tarpon. And I remember one time my dad was just like, well, I guess it was the first time, and we were over a manatee, which was very rare, but like manatee had found its way out, and he was like, we were on the same wave runner actually at this point. My brother must have been on the other one. And my dad was like, go on, jump on it. And I was like, what? He's like, go on, jump on it. And I was like, no way, dude. I'm like 9 years old. And he just pushes me. And but I had my mask on, right? And so I was like, ah, like this animal was twice the size of the boat. But and I pulled my mask down and I looked down and it just like awash. I was just awash with like this, oh, like love. Like now, what I understand it was love. To know what the feeling was at the time, though. But I was compelled to like swim down, and didn't really mind that I was there yet. And I swam down, and so much to see that like it did have hairs, but they were very sparse. Like I was like, wow, that's weird. And then I swam, and underneath there was a calf.
Oh, cool.
Just like, oh my God, like it was the coolest moment of my life, you know. And I was feel like, you know, and when I think about that story, like for a while, I was like, my dad was such an asshole. I can't believe he just pushed me in. But I'm so grateful he did, right? Like, I'm so grateful because my fear would have kept me back. But yeah, just the just moments like that. Like, I don't even know what brought that. I guess we're talking about passion, right? And yeah, oh no, that's what it was that I too had the experience sort of similar to what y'all are saying, where I would see the same dolphins every year and like notice by their dorsals, you know, and that had like the chunky barnacles, and then the one that had like the little weird looked like a mousie had like bitten out from it. And I mean, I for sure, like by age 15, because I had been hanging out with them probably since I was like 6 or 7 to like 15, and I was like, oh my God, yeah, what's up? And I feel like I need them, you know, like I feel like, and I would cut the engine so that I could hear, right? And I would just sit, and sometimes I would just lay there and like close my eyes and just hear the,
The blows, yeah.
yeah, and like, and just, oh, just the most incredible experience. I mean, I can't even, and like that was just my normal life. Like I didn't even realize what I would, you know, I didn't realize how crazy that was that I was getting to grow up that way. But that is what it's like, those memories and those things that have reignited this connection. And you know, when we first got on this call, I don't know if it's recorded, but I think it was Diane that was like, so what is your podcast about? And you know, the journey to discover the authentic self. And for me, it's been a really wild journey. You know, and like I've shared, like that, you know, I have this amazing, healthy, vibrant 7-year-old son. And then I also lost my second child at birth. And so to come around, and now with Riley Soleil, who has brought the light, which is why we named her that, I'm actually stepping into the fullness of my authentic self. And this is the flagship conversation for the reignition of the podcast. So I thank you all both for like basically holding my hands back into
No.
it. No, seriously, because I've always wanted, you know, to have conversations with marine biologists and to get into conservation, but I was always like, I don't know how, I'm just a yoga teacher, like I don't know what to do, you know.
Well,
But
it's been a lot of fun,
it's,
and I've
yeah, but
had
here we are,
some
you
interesting
know.
conversations, and
Yeah, and but I guess it's like I'm not afraid anymore, you know, like
yeah.
I'm not afraid to like stick my neck into places that like maybe I didn't think, with air quotes, that I belonged. But the truth is, like, we all belong in conservation. We all belong to this planet, and we belong to each other. You know, we belong to each other as humans just as much as we belong to the dolphins, and just as much as we belong to the pigeons and the squirrels and
And
whatnot.
I mean, I would just add to that that we all belong, but we also, as belongers, as people in that space, we need to accept some responsibility as well. And you know, and it's easy to throw your hands up and you know, there's nothing we can do, but just find what you can do, because there is something that we can all do. Just find your thing that you can do. And maybe it's, you know, not taking your own plastic bag or taking your own bags so you don't take a plastic bag from the grocery store, or, you know,
Whatever it is.
single-use water bottles, you know, whatever it is, there's something that we can all do. And if we all do that one thing, it will make a difference for sure.
Can't say it more perfectly. Oh, wow. Well, yeah, I mean, we can't end on a better note. So how we can help, how we can help as the listeners, is, I think it's better heard from y'all's mouths, but I, yeah, how can our listeners help? So the greater, you know, Rain Studios, community, which really is, in a crazy way, it's actually worldwide because of where the studio was, geographically in New Orleans. We had so many people that were coming and visiting from out of town, you know, tourists. It was literally about 50% was local, and then 50% was visitors. And so we stay in contact through this podcast. Now it has been 2 years since I've been on in communication, but what's cool is that they're all still there and eager to be a part. So how can we help?
Well, you're Charlotte's turn.
Well, you have to do everything Di said and more.
That's
Yeah.
right.
You can do more. You don't have to do one thing. You can do many things. You can go and become
I
a
mean help. I mean help
ufology.
them now
Yeah.
specifically. So I mean it is a call out to donate. I mean that's
Yes.
what
Yeah.
I
So
would really like to open that conversation, and I know we have to go, but
yeah.
just maybe to let listeners know, you know, what their generous donations would help do.
Yeah, so we would, our priority is this population of dolphins that have already suffered from the hurricane. And we would use any donations to conduct more research that will help to create policy, even if initially it's guidelines, the goal is policy that will help conservation. So slow down speed, slow down areas. And the way we scientifically know those areas requires more research. So that's us going in the boat and finding dolphins and marking down where we are, seeing what the dolphins are doing there. Are they socializing or foraging? The donations are literally to pay for our vessel fuel, to pay our salaries, small stipends for interns, camera equipment, data storage. It's not a lot of money, but it doesn't exist. And we have a relationship with the US organization that you can get your 501c. No, what is it? It is a
Yeah, U.S. tax
501c3, the
deduction.
US tax deduction for any donations. So that's on our website, which is bahamaswhales.org.
Which will all be on the show notes, yeah.
There's a donate page. And if you donate through there, you will get your tax deduction back for donating.
Yeah, our other focus right now is to increase our capacity. So, putting a call out for young Bahamians that are interested, that have some science background, that are interested in getting involved in this work, and so we can start to go through the process of passing the baton a bit and making sure that you know this work is continued on in the future, because there certainly will be more conservation issues that marine mammals face in the country
Yeah.
and around the world. And,
Yeah.
yeah. And
Beautiful.
I would like to say congratulations to you, Rain, for getting back on the horse, and how fortunate we feel to have been part of that too.
Yeah, I feel honored. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's so mutual. It's like the most beautiful thing I can possibly imagine. It's crazy. And I just look forward to, you know, eventually, hopefully sooner rather than later, getting down there and
Yeah.
being able to really to see, you know, to see the lens through which you all do your work, and just because I know that this is the beginning of something very, very beautiful and something quite strong also. You know, I really see that. Oh, it's been an honor and a privilege to have this lengthy conversation, and yeah, stay tuned for more from Diane and Charlotte, and we love you all.
Thank you so much, Rain.
Thank you.
Bye for now.
Bye for now.
Alrighty then. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Rain Studios podcast. That's a wrap on our show today. Feel free to check out the show notes for links to all the pertinent things from today's guests. And special thanks to Justin Briggs, who is the musician, to our beautiful music. as well as Mr. Thomas Jensen, who is an incredible musician here in Eugene, Oregon, and has come on board to help us with the sound editing and mixing and whatnot. So special thanks to those guys, and please tune into our next episode. It should be coming to you soon. Thank you, and until next time.